Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. On the day that we did this show, Frederick pointed out that it was George Lincoln Rockwell's birthday. So there on the screen is the late great George Lincoln Rockwell, the white man who founded the American Nazi Party and gave his life for the whites of America and for all whites. George Lincoln Rockwell, one of my heroes. In today's show, I was back with Frederick of Blackbird 9, as well as the Hillbilly Professor. And this show ended up with us chatting a lot about spying and using technology to spy on people. Frederick actually was quite a specialist with security clearances, and he was working for the US government. I did do a video with Frederick a long time ago about his knowledge of cell phones and why the cell phone calls on 9/11 were impossible. This is just one of many videos that I need to bring out and remind people about. But Frederick knew exactly how cell phones worked and cell phone towers worked and the technology behind it. And our Hillbilly Professor also has experience in analyzing large amounts of data, huge amounts of data, and getting results out of that. Frederick actually got into a lot of trouble when he started telling the truth, and his entire life was actually destroyed as a result of that. So in this show, we end up talking a lot about spying. And I thought that I'd just add in one or two things from the past, things that I published a long time ago and things that I learned a long time ago about emails and also just about spying. And in this show, you'll hear me talking about a guy that I knew who worked in the NSA in America. And I was looking through my old articles on African crisis, and I found one article where the US government was spying on people's work computers. And I'm talking almost 20 years ago. And something that I remember in the early days of the internet was that for a time in South Africa, people wanted, let's call it, their freedom on email. And the government just went and made a law. They passed a law, and the law was that all internet service providers had to install government software, government spying software, on their email servers. And it was that simple. The government makes a law and everybody has to comply with it. And if you don't comply with it, the CEO or the owner of the company is going to jail. Period. There's a lot of stuff that works exactly like that everywhere in the world. The notion that companies can protect you and companies can show the finger to the government, that's not true. The law is the law, and they'll put you in jail, period. And that's how it works everywhere in the world. You cannot go against the law of the land. And so it was that simple, just bing, bang, boom, and all South African email servers have got government spying software on them, and that's that. I actually had a very fascinating experience where I learned that the ruling party had intercepted my emails. It was quite a bizarre event, and I have mentioned it on videos before, but I actually found the original article. Also, in the early days of the internet, that's when cell phones came out, mobile phones came out, and then there were lots of whites who were saying that you can't spy on a mobile phone because a mobile phone is talking to different towers as you are moving. So there isn't one bottleneck where they can listen to you all the time. That was the theory. But within a few years, I actually ran into a guy at my work at the bank, and he was an Afrikaans guy who programmed cell phone towers. And he told me that every week, government officials would come to that particular cell phone company and would collect all the recordings that they had made of conversations on various cell phones. And again, the law does it all. All you need is the government to issue a court order. A judge or magistrate may issue a court order based on various evidence, and the court order will say that that cell phone company has got to spy on that telephone number and must hand over everything that it gets. It's that simple, and that company cannot ignore the court order. Otherwise, jail time for somebody. And this guy who programmed cell phone towers, he told me lots of very bizarre stories about the things that they can do with mobile phones. And the stuff I'm telling you is literally 20 years old. This guy told me that people like Nelson Mandela could get a cell phone. It would be free. He could phone any number in the world, and they could program the system so that he could phone anyone, anywhere, at any time, at no cost, and without any record of who he phoned and what they spoke about. When you're an engineer, you can do anything with all this electronic equipment. And of course, they can spy on phones even if you are driving around, because at the end of the day, all these towers are passing information back to central computers, and all of the discussions can be assembled by those computers. But I want to tell you a strange story before we start the show. I published this story in 2004. This story came from a local radio station here in Johannesburg, and I want to read it to you because it's quite a bizarre story. And this is the result of people having access to codes that you don't even know exist, and the kinds of things that they can do. These things are originally created for the engineers that are working on phones, and they are fixing problems and finding bugs and fixing things. So I published this on the 20th of August 2004, and this is what I wrote. My niece sent me this piece. It originates from Radio 702, a notable radio station in Johannesburg. This story was also printed in the Star newspaper, Johannesburg, but unfortunately I can't find an online copy. So here's the story. If you are a Vodacom subscriber, that is, this story has been all over 702 this morning. Also check out their website to verify. Yesterday, a listener called in to say that he was able to tap into cell phone conversations at random, and that it was apparently very easy. You just have to press a few buttons on the cell phone. 702 correctly did not reveal how to do it. The listener said that he got this from school kids, and that it is common practice for school kids to do this for fun during break times. They love the thrill of eavesdropping on lovers, tiffs, etc. Since then, a number of people and school kids have called in to confirm that this is in fact possible. 702 spoke to a Vodacom spokesperson yesterday who refuted this and said he was 100% sure that it could not be done. Vodacom is a big cell phone company in South Africa. He claimed that the listener must have been talking about their conference call facility or their chat room facility. 702 put it to the test, and hey presto, They were able to tap into various calls, in some cases hearing only one side of the conversation, and in other cases both. 702 played some snippets of the taped conversations this morning. One of them was a business deal being conducted. 702 has revealed this to Vodacom, who are presently investigating. They are presently refusing to comment. What is frightening about this is firstly the intrusion of privacy and secondly the security threat it poses. It will not take long before our ingenious criminals use this as a means of obtaining easy information about targets, and of course, not to mention blackmail. Both MTN and Cell C have confirmed that it is impossible on their networks. Famous last words. Then I commented further, I can easily believe this. I say that because cell phones are actually run by computers. In South Africa, all cell phones are digital. I do not actually want to reveal everything I have learned about cell phones, but I want to tell people, cell phones are not as safe as people have been led to believe. Look, no electronic communications mechanism is safe. There's no such thing. If it's electronic, it can be used to snoop on you. The idea that you can punch in a code and listen in on calls is interesting. Technically, I'm sure it's possible. It's like when you dial a certain code to get, say, an international number. There's nothing stopping the programmers from programming certain codes into cell phones as back doors so that they can access special features. I can't see it being difficult. There may be many such backdoors in cell phones which only engineers and programmers even know exist. I know some programmers who have worked for cell phone companies, and the stories they have told me are really interesting. Judging from the things I heard, I'd say there are all sorts of things that are possible on cell phones. Some people say that a cell phone can be used to track you according to which cell you happen to be in. Well, I was told that the information available from the beacons is much more directional than that. So being tracked by a cell phone with greater accuracy than just a cell may very well be possible. Let me pause there for a second. Nowadays, if you've got an Android phone, you'll know that they can track you to within a couple of meters of your location. You can even go and see it on Google Maps, etc. So all of this stuff is totally true and it's used all the time. You might even have experienced that Google will email you a map of all the places you went to during a month. And you'll see all the places that you drove to and walked to for a whole month. Computers are tracking you. Anyway, let me continue reading. It could be that backdoors have been created that would enable people to do certain things. This is a theoretical possibility. Such backdoors may have started out as tools to be used by the engineers and programmers to trace faults, etc. But later, such features could have been made available to or been demanded by government or security/intelligence services for their use. I would be curious to know how the children got hold of these codes in the first place. Who gave it away? I wonder if it wasn't an adult who was authorized to have this facility who gave it to his kid, and then the whole thing got out of hand. Finally, to truly tap a cell phone effectively, the only people who can do that properly are the cell phone companies through whose computers the calls run. Rest assured, if the government wants recordings of your cell phone conversations, they will make appropriate secret arrangements with the cell phone company who will then hand over your calls to them. Note, as a matter of policy, South African cell phone companies will not give you nor your spouse any copies of your calls. Apparently, spouses were doing this and it caused legal problems for the cell phone companies. So if you ever ask them for a recording, even of your own calls, you will be told it does not exist. But it does exist, and if the government feels you are a criminal or a threat to national security, they will get the recordings. So remember, a cell phone is not safe. No electronic means of communication is, and the top of the list of unsafe communication methods is computers. So that is what I wrote in 2004. What follows is the show with Frederick and the Hillbilly Professor, and you'll hear us talking a lot about all kinds of spying and what goes on. Today I'm back with the Hillbillies. I've not been abducted, but I'm in here with the Hillbillies today. So it's back with Sid and Frederick. Hi there, guys. How are you doing?
I'm well.
Greetings. Thanks for having me back from a beautiful rainy day here on Blackjack Mountain, North Kakalaki.
Well, over here, it's just hot and dry at the moment. So it's not so fun here. But our weather is not as variable as yours. But anyway, it's good to be getting a chance to chat to you guys again. And I just want to throw a few questions at you guys, and we can take it down whichever path. The first thing I just want to ask Sid is, you went to Ameren about 2 years ago, and I've seen a lot of Jared Taylor's stuff, but I kind of walked away with the view that he's very, very soft, almost a bit liberally, almost making a few excuses. But then recently someone sent me a video from him that really impressed the hell out of me. And I've never actually dug into his background, and I didn't realize how long he's been doing this stuff. So I walked away and I was thinking, you know, Jared Taylor's not bad. He deserves a lot more respect than the negative things that I'd been hearing. And he has been hammering away quite well. So tell me a little bit about how it was at Ameren when you went there, Sid.
So I would describe him as a southern gentleman. He lived in Japan for a year, and he speaks fluent Japanese of all things. So that's sort of interesting, because I lived in Japan for years myself. And I could not speak a word Japanese. Their grammar is totally beyond my powers of comprehension. But yeah, and he calls himself a white advocate, and they've questioned him about the JQ issue. And he goes, look, I recognize patterns, but he says, you know, I'm biting off a big bite of the sandwich by being a white advocacy for, you know, white advocacy. And he says, I just don't want to be a crackpot in too many issues. So I think he's strategic and smart about that. He just eschews that issue because you can't, I mean, you know, he's running a decent conference down there and a little, you know, a decent organization. So you got to be strategic with the. That's the way I look at it. I mean, you got to be strategic with the how many bites out of the sandwich you take type of deal. So that's the way I look at him, and I think he's a good guy. He's a good guy. He's got integrity, in my opinion. So yeah.
So tell me a bit, when you say he runs an organization, like how many people come there? What is his sort of reach, etc.?
Well, you know, it's funny because it was there wasn't too many oddballs. There was like one Indian guy running around with a Hitler mustache at the conference, but there's a lot of academicians, and it's a little bit higher. You know, it's not a bunch of grugs. And I don't know, probably 300-400 people show up at the conference. So he has it every year. It's not too far from where I am. So I went to it once. I'd like to go again, actually. But it was good to meet people. But yeah, I talked to people when I was there that had organized the Charlottesville stuff. And of course, that was a trap. That turned out to be a trap. But I mean, there's the movers and shakers within the movement show up there. And there are some, you know, a lot of guys that had written books and stuff like that. I thought it was pleasant because it's very seldom that you get to talk to people that think like us, right? And it was full of those. So I had a good time. So, yeah.
So how long were you there? Was it like a one-day event with speakers and so forth?
Yeah. Yeah, it was like I think it was two days in total. But, yeah, they have little cabins down there. And I can't remember the name of the park that they have it in. It's a Tennessee State Park. And Tennessee has pretty good laws about, you know, it was well run. I mean, you know, they had Antifa, but they had them roped off. And they had cops on horses and stuff like that. So there was no chance of violence or anything along those lines. So that's what I mean by well run. It wasn't like a free for all. And it was well run. And Tennessee has pretty good laws, freedom of speech laws. So he has it in a Tennessee State Park. And I can't, Montgomery State Park, I believe. And they got facilities there. And it was pleasant. I mean, very pleasant.
So what is his background? What got him into this white advocacy? Because I think I heard something that he had some kind of African experience, like he was maybe in West Africa and he saw something.
You know, I'm not an expert on him, but I think what it was, I think he was in Japan, and the Japanese, they're culturally homogenous and they're unapologetic about it. And then he just got to seeing the way whites were getting kicked around. And it's like, well, this is bullshit. And he is Southern. He's a Southern guy. He's even got a Southern accent and stuff. So I think that's what did it. But I'm not an expert. I'd be hesitant to comment further.
Okay. No, because he sounds like a guy I wouldn't mind having contact with him. But I think. I think he might not want to have contact with me because, you know,
I get that a lot.
I'm probably in crackpot space. So Frederick, you and I, we got to put on our tinfoil hats. But you know what? The tinfoil hat guys are going to be turning out to know the truth. We know the truth ahead of the time. That much I will tell you. So, yeah. So you get lots of people telling you that you're a crackpot.
Oh, it's just that, you know, I always joke about it being, you know, when you get blackballed or blacklisted, you know, it's you're literally being cursed. So I just tell them, you know, I got the curse and everybody's scared to hang out with me because all my buckets of hate facts, you know, noticing those patterns that they're not comfortable with.
We talked about this before because I was there when 9/11, I was in biomedical sciences and DARPA. Which is the funding agency, they were coming out with all this stuff where, you know, biometrics. And so I was attuned to the fact that they were listening to a lot of conversations. And I think Frederick was right in the middle of that. And then he ended up getting blackballed. But yeah, they're intercepting every communication, and they're coming up with software. I was in big data, and I've talked to Frederick about this previously. And in big data, you got to come up with software, a new software that'll map networks, and you're going to make sense of all, you know, there's thousands of, you know, data points with metabolomics or genomics. So I was attuned to that. And then, I followed up on it, and that's exactly what the NSA is doing. I mean, and then the other intelligence agencies, they're mapping networks of us and trying to figure out who the problem people are. Frederick could talk to it more intelligently, probably.
Oh, yeah, that's spot on when you see, you know, the whole project of, you know, not only were they spying on everybody, it was in place before 9/11. That's the big thing people need to get their heads around, is you know, the only U.S. telecommunication company that refused to go along with it was Quest. And they basically made an example out of their CEO, Joseph Nacho, and they put him in prison under trumped up insider trading laws, which I believe he was later found innocent of. But they just had to get him out of the way. And he and I were like the only two people saying this was in place before 9/11. They justified everything with 9/11, right? But the you know, the more we find out about, you know, how dark this gets, you know, that, you know, Bill Clinton was completely compromised through the Jeffrey Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell, Ehud Barak, you know, blackmail ring that was in place. And Clinton was the one who appointed General Michael Hayden, you know, in charge of the NSA. And I always tell people, you know, the event that changed the world, 9/11, between the world that it was and the new world, required absolutely zero changes to my entire curriculum. I didn't have to make any changes because everything, as they expected out, was exactly how they wanted it. And the big thing was that, you know, I was trying to prove in 2003 that, you know, there was a pipe behind the NSA pipe, and I wasn't able to do it before I got blacklisted. I got blacklisted in February of 2003, and of course in March 2003 on Purim is when we went into Iraq based on, you know, trumped up, you know, cooked intelligence, as they say. But when you look at, you know, Israel and their, you know, philosophy, their worldview of, you know, we're the chosenites and everyone exists to serve us. And then you know, look at people like Noah Harari and his obsession with data and Sergey Brin and Larry Page at Google. And, you know, they were completely, you know, Soviets that got ran out of Russia, came to the U.S. and started up shop. And it's basically, you know, and then you go back and look at how was the Stasi set up? How was the Cheka set up? How was the NKVD set up? You know, how has Rothschild and the Illuminati been infiltrating everything since Zabotai Zevi? You know, so you see the pattern, and basically they are putting in a grading system of, you know, grading, sorting, and culling. And like, you know, Sid was saying, it's all about bubbling up to the top the people that are going to be problematic, and you go in and you take them out. And you've got this completely compromised Mockingbird media that basically gives the thumbs up approval to every time they do something like this. So somebody like Jared Taylor, you know, if he's out there talking about white advocacy, you know, that is completely contrary to the agenda. So he has to be taken out. And, you know, so he has to be so careful what he says in the public eye, and he knows where the third rails are. You know, somebody like me, I've already lost everything. I'm ahead of the curve, you know, so I have always had that, you know, Don Quixote, you know, cavalier stance on, you know, my advocacy work. And of course, you know, that kind of puts me over there in that tinfoil hat radical guy that everybody's scared to be associated with. But slowly over the years, you know, it's amazing how many people have, you know, risked coming around that old Blackbird guy and listening to what he has to say and, you know, connecting the dots. So anyway, back to you.
This is very interesting. This thing about the NSA spying on everything, I just want to ask you a question, Frederick. I don't know if you can answer this, but in the work that you were doing, did you have any sort of security clearances?
Yes. When I first went to out of college university, a place called Research Triangle Institute in the Research Triangle Park of North Carolina between the cities of Chapel Hill, Durham, and Raleigh, which is the capital city of North Kakalaki. It was a big think tank that went in after World War II, and RTI was one of the first research facilities in that project. And I had to get all my security clearances because I was handling secure research on all the, you know, classified computers. So I had to go through all the security training, et cetera. And then as my career, you know, advanced and I went to work for IBM and some startups and finally into this place called Global Knowledge, I would have to be cleared to go into all those various secured areas. And so, you know, I had, you know, lots of security clearances depending on, and also in other countries. You know, that was when I was one of those fixer guys that flew out, you know, pager. Back then we had pagers, and yeah, my pager would go off in the middle of the night. I had to get a go bag and go to whatever country or whatever to fix whatever problem they were having. And it's amazing how quickly you can get cleared through a security wall if they are needing your skill set. You know, so basically I would get walked through security because they needed me to fix whatever they had. You know, under normal circumstances, you know, they would be, you know, oh, that the letter of the law, you've got to do this, 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 and this, you know, but I would get waved through in some pretty interesting places. So that's basically my story.
Now, that's very interesting. So you had certain technical knowledge that was of critical importance to them. Did you get to see I'm trying to think how to ask you this question. Were you mainly, let's call it technical, in the sense that your work is technical of a computer or software or hardware nature, or did your work involve seeing data about people and things that would happen to people?
That's an excellent point. You know, one of the things about what I was doing in the run-up to 9/11 was moving from support engineering, technical support, where I was actually going out and fixing the things that were broken. I was designing systems for various scalable size companies, doing consulting work, and then moving into training. I was working for when IBM's network hardware division went away. We formed a company called Networking Bootcamp Company to train all the IBM engineers on the new Cisco gear that they're going to be using instead of IBM gear, right? And that's where I got the attention of this company called Global Knowledge out of Cary, North Carolina, that wanted me to help them develop this set of third generation transition. That was back in the days where you still had telephone networks and data networks and cell phone networks and never the three shall meet, right? And what we were doing with third generation was combining, you know, phone service, computer service, and cell phone service over one network. That was the big goal. And so I was brought in to help design a series of classes on this new technology of convergence and voice over IP technology. And my clients were everyone from just companies to the actual manufacturers of the cell phones, you know, the big telcos, AT&T, Verizon, you know, all those. And then the developers, you know, pieces like Motorola, et cetera, and Booz Allen Hamilton, MITRE, General Dynamics, RANCOR, which were associated with all the intelligence agencies, and then the actual intelligence agencies themselves, CIA, NSA, FBI, various state SBIs. And I was training the analysts for the NSA and Booz Allen Hamilton and stuff. And that's when I saw what they were doing. And one of the interesting things about the NSA was the first thing when I was customizing the class for the NSA, I told my, you know, person I was working with, I asked them rather, which version of the class do you want? The E1 version, which is everybody else's telephony in the world, or the T1 version, which is for U.S. telecommunications. Now, U.S. telecommunications were supposed to be off limits to the NSA. Well, it was the big red flag was when they specifically said they wanted the T1, that's Tango 1, signaling, which is just U.S. telephone network. So I knew that they were going to be spying on Americans. And then I had modules in the training about both the Constitution First and Fourth Amendments and the FISA laws. And the NSA coordinator had me remove those because it was causing conflict in the classes because it was confusing those best and brightest 20-something analysts who are being told that, you know, what the Fourth Amendment is all about is we just can't use what we find in a U.S. court of law, but that doesn't matter because we're generating kill lists. Right. And that we can spy on anybody, anytime, anywhere, because we're the NSA and 9/11 justified everything. Right. So you have these brainwashed kids thinking that, you know, what we do is beyond, you know, outside of the courts of the United States. Right. And the maddening part is when we finally proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that all this was taking place. Our compromised Congress critters under newly elected President Obama promptly pardoned the entire telecommunication industry, many of which were alumni of Israel's Unit 8200. If you look at the CEOs and the executive officers of all of these American telecommunication companies, you find that the majority of them were alumni from Israel's Unit 8200. Magically, they got called heroes for stepping up and breaking the law after 9/11 and doing what had to be done, even if they were breaking the law just a little bit. But they're heroes, and they're now immune from prosecution under, you know, President Obama, right? After all that work, we went to finally prove it. They kept denying it and denying it and denying it. Then they finally said, we did it, but we're heroes for doing it. And Mockingbird Media, you know, spread this thing that, you know, the telcos are all heroes for setting up this big surveillance trap that every American is being triaged to see, you know, whether or not you're going to live after the Great Reset, basically, if they get their plan. So that's kind of my story. Back to you.
That's very interesting. I want to ask you some more questions. You mentioned a thing called an SBI. I've never heard of that. What's an SBI?
I meant to say ISP, Internet Service Provider. And so basically you have your telcos, telecommunication companies, and internet service providers, and we merge those into one thing. So now your cable television or your phone company is also your internet service provider.
So just correct me, I lost you a little bit there. Are you saying that SBI and ISP is the same thing?
No, if I said anything besides internet service provider, I misspoke. It's a Saturday morning here.
Okay.
I meant to say ISP.
Okay. So you meant to say ISP. Okay. No problem. No, I thought it was some other thing. And you mentioned the concept of generating.
Oh, SBI. That's our. Oh, I know. I was talking about FBI and SBI. SBI is your state level Bureau of Investigations, right?
Ah, okay. So the state has got its own Bureau of Investigations.
Police. Yes.
Okay. First time I've ever heard of an SBI, and the term kill list. It's obviously not to really kill people. I assume it's to blacklist people or something.
Well, I don't be so sure about that.
Don't you start now.
Yeah, really, because General Michael Hayden, he bragged before we exposed all this. He was bragging about we use metadata to generate kill lists. And that's a pretty much, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but that's pretty much what he said repeatedly, that the NSA is generating kill lists largely from metadata, right? And, you know, the thing is, they are collecting data and metadata on every person in the world, and especially on Americans, to generate, you know, threat assessments, as they call it. And then that gets dispatched to your operatives, you know, so your analysts, you know, that figure out who's on the naughty list, that gets passed over to your operatives, and then your operatives figure out how to take you out using either soft power or hard power, depending on what they're authorized to do based on your threat assessment. It was one of the terrifying things is knowing all this was in place. And the first time I would get stopped at a traffic stop after 9/11 and hand them my license and just wonder, is this guy just going to shoot me because of what his computer says I am? You know, am I going to get arrested because I'm flagged or whatever? Is he just going to treat me like everyone else? You know, that's the thing. Well, they get to see the screen, but you don't.
Mike Pompeo, he was caught on tape discussing the murder of Julian Assange. I mean, these people are ruthless.
Yeah, Hillary Clinton wanted to kill Julian Assange. It's like, can't we just, you know, kill him, you know, for telling on us?
That's very interesting. Mike Pompeo is a Jew, from what I understand.
I'm not so sure. The William Barr is definitely Jewish. He's got a Jewish background, which they changed their names. Even in the town I live in, it's funny because I was going to the liquor store and I was asking, who owns this place? And they're like, well, this guy, and he has a Christian name. And I said, he's not Jewish, is he? Yeah, he converted. So there's actually, in the area I am, there's still crypto Jews. And there's a lot of that that goes on. I think William Bagpipe Barr is Jewish. So if you look into the backgrounds of some of these people, and Unit 8 200, Blackbird's exactly right about that. I mean, essentially, what I've concluded, and this might be a little wild theory, but we're being run by a Jewish mafia here in the United States for all intents and purposes. So I'd like somebody
exactly.
to prove me wrong with that.
No, that's exactly what we have.
Okay, that's a big topic. Well, all I'll say is that I have seen a video of Mike Pompeo wearing a yarmulke. I have seen that.
Right. He is affiliated with the Presbyterian Church. He considers himself an evangelical Zionist, basically. And so he has a picture of him at the Roman wall that they call the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, going through the humiliation ritual of, and that's how he has, Israeli support and Jewish support in the U.S. But he technically is a Presbyterian, according to this page.
Oh, okay. Then that would explain. So he's a Christian Zionist. Oh, God. Okay. Well, thanks for correcting that. So this, just getting back to the basic theme of what you've now raised here. When I started my African crisis, I made my first American friends there. And interestingly enough, there was one black guy who actually came to African Crisis a lot, and I actually had a lot of contact with him. And that black guy told me that he was an auditor at the NSA. And I don't generally take blacks that seriously, but I will tell you some things about some of my discussions with him, which is like 20 years ago. At a point, we were looking at sending some stuff to each other via email, and the black guy said to me, you probably remember a thing called PGP, and he said to me the only thing that he will ever use to send a message to another person is to use PGP, and I need to set up PGP, and then we set up our keys, and that's how we talk to each other. And so that was his sort of feedback there. But he had one other thing that he said. He said to me that every single electronic communication inside America or going in and out of America. Every single electronic piece of communication is spied on by the NSA. That's what he said.
Yeah, that's become apparent. I mean, that they've definitely done that. I mean, the problem they have, though, is you got thousands of people talking and sorted out. That's their dilemma. And I like people spouting off because it provides, what is it, chaff, or when the airplane throws out stuff to attract this. Yeah. So,
flak problems. Oh, okay.
That's what we're dealing with. And so I was in the big data game, and I was going to conferences and stuff, and they were recruiting us because they wanted people to develop software and to sort out all the information. And at Blackbird, he was a black hat apparently there for a while until he wised up. So, he could probably expound upon that.
Look, the little bit.
Okay, I take exception with being called a black hat. I was teaching people how things worked, how the technology worked. How they choose to apply it is their business. But my job was to explain how it worked.
I apologize.
Yeah, it's okay.
But I'm seeing it because I've got a kid that's a National Merit Scholar, so he's super smart. I mean, he's probably got 150 IQ, and they're recruiting him into this, the satellite business, and he's doing his PhD now. And the guy was telling him, because the guy is a foreigner, and he's saying, yeah, dude, if you go into this, because the military is constantly bugging me to, you know, work for him, but I'm not a citizen, so I can't. And he goes, but you being a natural born citizen, you'll make out like a bandit. So I'm seeing them with my kids, because I've got several kids, and they're recruiting them like the MIT. And they're pretty efficient about recruiting the brains into the organization. So, yeah.
Now, the notion of the NSA spying on everybody and the world, I don't have a problem with that in the sense that it is technically feasible. The little bit that I've read of NSA history was that even as far back as the 1950s, but I know that even by the 1960s, the NSA had ships and planes moving around across the world, just sucking data, just sucking radio waves in, recording everything. You know, that's where the USS Liberty, for example, comes into the picture. The USS Liberty was just one of many spy ships, and there were spy planes and everything. So America's been sucking data out of the air for decades, and for them to spy on every single email and to have software that can listen to every conversation and start taking voice and turning it into text and searching for keywords. I assume that's the kind of stuff that you guys are also thinking of.
Well, the facial recognition, I mean, so they can track every movement. Even my wife tracks me using my cell phone. But they're taking every piece of information, but not only that, they're collating it and organizing it into, you know, problematic people and here and there. And so you got to be very, very cautious when you're a dissident, for instance. So, yeah.
Okay, well, if you're doing something illegal, then it sounds like for them to catch you is going to be a piece of cake. But if they are just, I know that they are kind of trying to predict the problematic people. But have you guys, Have you guys seen stuff that indicates to you how effective this is? And the other thing, there is something else I want to ask, but let's go with that. Let me also add in this question to both of you. Can it be that they can come and quietly destroy your life without you knowing it? Let me leave it at that.
Well, I think you have to become prominent. So I'm like a low-level fruitcake. So, I'm not totally worried about that. But they have. And they've assassinated people and they've taken people out. But I'm not sure. I mean, that's a thing. It's hard to know. I mean, you do have, you know, I was curious. Tucker Carlson was using Signal, which is supposed to be a secure network, and they were listening to his emails. So when he was trying to set up his interview with Putin, they stepped in. And so there's a few little stories out there about that. But I mean, there's only so many of them. I mean, we're talking about several thousand people that are involved in that sort of thing. So, I'm not sure. It's hard to know.
Look, when it comes to national security, they'll do anything. There's nothing they can't get into. And by the way, Frederick, I looked up Unit 8200. That's 8200. That is the Israeli Defense Force Military Intelligence Directorate. It says Military Intelligence Unit, role clandestine operations, collecting signal intelligence and code decryption, counterintelligence, cyber warfare, etc. So basically, Military Intelligence Unit.
Right, and they also do outreach to Jewish summer camps that are located throughout the U.S., which is interesting that Israel sends over all these Mossad, IDF, Unit 8200, Talpiot handlers to work with the Jewish school children at summer camp during the summers when the white kids are learning how to build campfires and put up tents and stuff. One of the things, you know, about, you know, this idea of surveillance, the surveillance state, in the early days of radio, they had these things called elephant cages or ANFLR9s, which were basically these huge antenna arrays that would pick up all the radio traffic bouncing off the ionosphere and then hand it over to their analysts to, you know, decrypt it and, you know, threat assess it, right? And this became known as, you know, the Echelon program, where they was going to sweep up all radio telecommunications. And what I was doing was basically taking Echelon and applying it to the telecommunication grid, it's the same thing that the Stasi was doing in Germany. And, you know, the Stasi, the thing that killed them was they had so much data that they were just overwhelmed with it. They couldn't, you know, it was too much to make patterns of. But now with supercomputing, what it is, and, you know, AI software and code development where it is now, you know, that's no longer the issue. And so basically what you had was these devices called splitters, and, you know, they're manufactured in Israel. A big companies, Naris and the other one escapes me at the moment, but, you know, two main manufacturers that provided this optical splitter. So every signal got split off and went across what we call black runs or black cables, your black networks, back to Israel. And that was what I was trying to prove in 2003 when I got blacklisted, and Edward Snowden finally proved it working out of Booz Allen Hamilton, because that was who was doing the code for all of this. And he exposed that in 2013. right? So yeah, that is definitely what they're doing at this level of every piece of signal intelligence, mapping it, tracking you down, and doing a threat assessment on you. And this is what they're going for. And so, like I said, to get your head around their end game, just listen to people like Klaus Schwab, George Soros, and Noah Harari, when they talk about, this post-free will world where everything's about your social credit score, whether you're allowed to get access to your money, your credits. You won't have physical money anymore, and they will decide if you can buy that pizza or not, that kind of thing. And to put all this, with your medical records, your dental records, et cetera, your education records, and all this profiling you, to deciding what your social credit score is. And like I said, it's moving towards a post-free will society. So back to you.
Yeah, no, they want to establish this digital currency so they can track every transaction. They hate cash. So that's another big thing. I'm a big fan of that Whitney Webb, and I'm surprised Snowden's still alive. So that's all I wanted to say about that. But, yeah, he's a brave guy, I think.
It was interesting in when Tucker Carlson was in Russia, he didn't get to officially interview Edward Snowden, but he did have dinner with him. And Edward Snowden just did not – yes, he just did not want to be interviewed while he lives in exile in Russia. So I thought that was interesting. So I'd love to be a fly on the wall to hear what they were talking about over dinner.
That's very interesting, because isn't Snowden, if he returns to America, it's straight into jail for him, for treason.
Or to Gitmo, if Hillary Clinton had her way, he'd be dead in Gitmo already.
Okay, very interesting. You see, the thing about the Jews in America is Jews are so integrated into all your systems and all your stuff, and they move around it in so many places, whether it's government or military or business. It's kind of freaky what the Jews are doing in your country. It's freaky. But one...
Well,
okay, go for it.
I think in World War II, they teamed up the mafia, our intelligence services teamed up with the mafia, and they essentially melded. So, but then the Jewish mafia sort of set aside the Italian mafia. And so, yeah, that's essentially what we have, a Jewish mafia that runs a lot of our stuff. And we used to have defenses against it because WASP used to, be like a little suspicious of Jewish influence. But yeah, not anymore. So, yeah, they're running roughshod. And guys like, I think Tucker Carlson, and I already talked about this, but I used to hate that guy because he's wearing his little bow tie and stuff. But I think there's a little bit of pushback from the WASP now against them running roughshod over every system that we have in place. So I might be wrong about that. So it's hard to tell.
No, you're spot on. And interesting, one of those hate facts is on September 11th. Notice how they love that. September 11th, 1931, there was a systematic purge of over 30 old style Christian mafia bosses, the Mustache Pete's, as they were called by the Jewish mob. And it was such a remarkable feat of planned execution that it just, stood down the Goyim organized crime rings and established Meyer Lansky's reign under Murder Incorporated. And then his heir apparent was Sheldon Adelson, who basically has normalized and legitimized Jewish organized crime, as just normal. It's just like Israel, where, the original terrorists of the Nakba in 40, in the run up to 48, were the Stern Gang, the Purple Gang, the Ergen, and suddenly they become a state, and now they're supposedly respectable as the Mossad and the IDF and the Shin Bet and Unit 8200, right? So, intelligence agencies are a crime. They think they are outside the rule of law. And this is, that whole thing of, what is your law system if you allow this, mob to be, affecting your life in negative ways. And so I just thought I'd throw that little factoid out, but you're spot on.
Yeah, look, I do agree. Hey, when you move into the military game, anything goes. Anything goes. They can decide to do all kinds of things. There is something that does bother me about the white right that I have thought about many times, and it is when you guys talk about profiling and profiling individuals, but there is also, I assume, the profiling of people and groups and whether people come together. And whether certain people or certain groups might have certain power. One thing that I've wondered about many times is whether these people can predict whether they've got because I'm sure they've got this ability. If you are processing data, and maybe Sid can, I think both of you could have input on this. If you are processing masses of data about people, you should surely be able to look at groups of people. I actually put out a video about some Jewish professor bitch in America. I put out a video about her about 3 or 4 years ago. And she was using data. She was getting data, I think, from Facebook and other places. And she was processing that data in order to find all the, quotes, extremists and anti-Semites and stuff like that. But the thing that I worry about is whether they are figuring out whether lots of whites are starting to wake up and whether they are able to either put out propaganda or do certain things to target people so that the group as a whole does not move forward. Because it's like the white right starts moving, and then something happens, and then everything falls apart. And then a couple of years later, the white right starts moving again, and then boom, something happens, and then they all start falling apart. Do you guys have any thoughts on this? And by the way, there's got to be like books or things. There must be somebody who's said something like this, or some academics have to be involved in this. Any thoughts?
Well, I mean, Biden in a speech declared the white extremist, and he used the word white as the biggest problem in America. So the gloves have come off on that end. I mean, I was shocked when I heard that. So, yeah, I mean, the gloves have largely come off, and white extremists. I don't even know what that is necessarily, but what was the word he used, Blackbird?
About?
He said the biggest problem or the biggest threat to our democracy is white extremism, or
It's like, white rural rage. That's the new.
Oh, threat. That was the latest thing.
Yeah, the threat to American democracy, but white rural Americans, MAGA Americans, are the biggest threat to American democracy. So he's basically trying to, demonize all the Trump supporters as being just like Hitler, just being like brown shirts, and that, you know, everybody else has to band together against the white European Christian society because we're a threat to democracy, right?
Well, and it's the same thing with them trying to recruit foreigners into our military because, you know, they need a janissary class to put us down, apparently, or I don't know. But there's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of people that are concerned, too. And I think that's what sort of what's happened with Tucker. He's like, man, what the hell is going on here? Because, I hope that's what happened.
I've got something to add in there with your remarks about non-whites that are getting into all kinds of high positions in America, because I noticed that they seem to have no problem getting other races into important places in your country. George Lincoln Rockwell, the founder of the American Nazi Party, in his original book, I think it's White Power, he had a very interesting chapter that I actually want to revisit. He made an interesting prediction, and he wrote a chapter called The Nightmare. I think it's called The Nightmare. In his chapter called The Nightmare, he predicts what the Jews are going to do in the future. And he's maybe decades and decades ahead of his time. George Lincoln Rockwell predicted, he wrote in the Nightmare chapter, he said something like this. He said, the tanks are coming, you know, the military armor is coming. And it's the American military is coming at the whites, and it's shooting at people and killing the whites, etc. And then he says, the turret opens, and out comes the soldier, and the soldier that's inside is black. And so he was basically predicting that the Jews will get the non-whites to use your stuff to kill you. And that's a valid interpretation of Jewish thinking.
Well, it's not the blacks, because they're generally incompetent. It's the Indians.
but the concept being getting other races to come at you. I'm with you.
Well, I said that last time we talked. It's like I talk to the guys because we get a lot of recruits from around here, and I tell them, don't ever fire on your own people. So, yeah, they got to find other people that'll shoot us. So I think that's what's going on. I mean, it's clear as day.
And I just want to wish Commander Rockwell a happy birthday. He was born March 9th, 1918, and passed and was assassinated on August 25th, 1967, as he was exposing all this commie madness back then. But, yeah, you're spot on with, you know, this idea of replacement troops. And one of the things we're having here in the United States is recruitment numbers are just in the basement. It's just the recruiters cannot get people to sign up, especially high IQ white European people from the Southeast, you know, the Southern states. They realize that this military no longer represents them. They are not going to, you know, fight for somebody that wants them gone, right? So this is the awakening of that, you know, 18 to 25 year old right now. And so they're not going into the military. And so what you see happening in under the Biden administration is this path to citizenship, where they're basically taking these people that are coming across the border illegally, saying, if you go into the military for 4 years, you'll have a path to citizenship, and we'll send you to college, et cetera, et cetera. And these people would have no qualms whatsoever firing on, you know, Americans. You know, that's just not in their mindset. And so you've got this, you know, low IQ. They keep reducing the standards to try to fill the number of seats they need, right? And so you got this, you know, low trained, low IQ, low EQ, just, you know, somebody that's going to react suddenly without using any reason. And it's just like, you know, Trotsky said, in his strategy of, you know, how are we going to roll out the Bolshevik Revolution? And he said, governments come and go, but the police remain, right? And so this idea of, you know, the police are just going to follow orders, just like military men are just going to follow orders. And so what you do is you change the head of the snake, right? And they will follow you anywhere. And so now, instead of your local sheriff, standing by you to run the invaders out of town, your local sheriff is more likely, that's been certified through diversity training, to arrest you for being a racist by protesting the fact that your daughter just got raped from some Somalian, right? And so, yeah, this is the mindset here is just, you know, it's, you know, clown world, because everything's, you know, the exact opposite of what it should be. And then the compound of that is, you know, UN troops bringing in United Nations blue helmets to curb the unrest in the United States during a civil war, right? And then leaving the U.S. under UN control. You know, is this a means to their end of doing away with the constitutional republic? So just back to you.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. If I was a policeman, they told me, okay, you got to go out and kneel to a bunch of Negroes, I would have been, I resign. So they made them go out and kneel. I was flabbergasted. And where they were burning down towns. And I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm just sitting here going, this is crazy. And so I don't know what they're going to do with the police. And that's one of my big things. And I've had people that want to move up to where I am in the Appalachian Mountains, and they'll ask me, how's your sheriff? And I was surprised at first, but now I start to understand. And so I think that's one thing on the local level, sheriffs, and because they have a lot of power in the United States, the sheriff does. They can run the ATF out of town, and the ATF is the worst organization in the world as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, so... I don't know. That might be one vector to fight back.
Oh, I always say, you know, your sheriff selection and your local coroner medical examiner election are the two most important things that will affect you and your family directory. If you have a corrupt sheriff, he's going to let these Fed agencies just come in and run roughshod over the county. You know, I can't do anything because the Fed says this. If you've got a good sheriff that's looking after your people, he will keep the, you know, Fed's NGO groups out of the county and have the authority to do so, right? And, you know, your medical examiner, they're, you know, giving real causes of deaths, right? When these, you know, criminals, these you know, hit squads start assassinating people, and you've got a corrupt medical examiner that says, oh, it's just an accident. He shot himself in the back of the head three times. Oh, you know. But yeah, that's the kind of stuff you run into.
Well, I've got some thoughts here. Very interesting stuff. And I just want to say that I have sat and thought in the past a lot because of my computer background. I didn't have access to the kinds of data that you guys have had access to, but I did work in big corporations and banks, and I know the kind of data that they have and that they process, and they can process large amounts of data. One thing that I did think about a lot in my early days on the internet was about this notion that you're being spied on, and the notion that you're going to be spied and tracked in all kinds of ways. And I sat and thought about it, and I have asked myself many times, even if they have all that data, how effectively can they really use it? And the big thing that I think also comes out of this chat, and you guys are kind of hinting at it yourselves, is if people start understanding and questioning what's going on and people start thinking in, let's say, conspiracy terms, and policemen start questioning why they're getting orders, and military are questioning. If you can spread those concepts among other Americans so that people start asking more questions and thinking more in those ways, then they're going to have a really hard time actually pulling this stuff off. And they may technically be able to do it, but when they get to the point where they really, really are trying to do big things and kill people in a big way, it's not just 111 anymore or something like that, then I think this plan can fall apart. Because, and another thing also that I want to mention, you guys are mentioning that they are struggling to recruit people for your military. Now, I was watching some videos where the British in Britain, in the UK, they are struggling to get people to join their military. Literally nobody inside England wants to fight for the UK anymore. And all these kinds of things start putting politicians and everybody in a spot. And I like this. I think that, you know, Jews may come up with all kinds of weird, creepy plans, but at the end of the day, if enough normal people start questioning and becoming suspicious, I think that this will fall apart. And the other thing that I also want to tell you is, in South Africa, we're in a much worse state than you. But we've already gone far past the point where you are. So we already have most of our people out of the military. We already have most of our people no longer in government and in intelligence agencies. Most of the whites are no longer that used to be in the police. We used to totally dominate the police. Most of them are gone. So now we're already in a, let's call it George Lincoln Rockwell scenario. But Now I look at the efficiency of the non-whites with governmental powers versus the whites who are now, let's say, thrown out and they're independent and they're on their own. And I want to tell you that my analysis from here in South Africa is that if they throw whites out of government, out of the military, etc., and then the Jews think that they can use the government and the military to crush the civilian whites, I reckon the civilian whites will be able to crush the military.
Well, I think they're in a panic right now. I mean, and you're starting to see it. The leftist, my views have changed completely in the last 5 years, because it's like, what the heck? And the leftists are, you know, this Gaza war and in this Russia war, and they're starting to act up. So I think they're in a panic, and that's why they're saying no, white rural right. White rural rights, rural whites are the biggest threat against democracy. I mean, they would never come out and say that, say, 5-10 years ago. So I think they're in a little bit of a panic, because people are starting to catch on to, you know, the situation. And I mean, normal people, I mean, Tucker Carlson is the most what would you call him? BB, what would you call Tucker? He's like a conventional person. Some of the stuff he's been saying has shocked me recently. So, yeah, I think they're in a little bit of a panic. because you're right.
Yeah. I always think people like Tucker Carlson is what we call a limited hangout. Yeah, they're going to give you this much information, but they're not going to take that next step, you know, into the JQ or the JP, right? But they're still, you know, a good source for information. You just have to be careful what you believe, right? And last time we talked about, you know, all the Jewish science experiments on white Europeans, especially Americans. Two of the big ones was the Solomon Asch group conformity experiment, and the other was the Stanley Milgram defer to authority experiments. And, you know, I was telling about how with Solomon Asch, he could basically gaslight up to 74% of the goyim in his experiments, provided he could completely control the echo chamber, that no other truth but their truth got into that echo chamber. He could gaslight up to 74% of a test population, right? But if one truth advocate got entered into that echo chamber, that number quickly went from 74% down to less than 5%. And so one of the things they look for is that what we call the 1 of 20 rule, or the 5% rule of leadership, where basically you put 20 people together in a room, one is going to emerge as the natural leader. You take 20 of those types, put them together, one is going to emerge as the natural leader. This is just mathematical statistics of our psychic makeup, right? And you know, so their algorithms are about how to isolate that 1 of 20 people like you two and myself, and make sure that we don't have a voice. So here in Little Watauga County, North Kakalaki, when the Adams Publishing propaganda, you know, Globo Homo family moved in here, invaded, and bought up all of these family-owned newspapers throughout the Appalachian Mountains and weaponized them to push this Globo Homo LGBTQ, you know, agenda, as this is good for our communities. You know, yes, welcome the stranger, you know, love thy neighbor, love God, welcome everybody to these mountains. And, you know, he was skull and bones, right? You know, so this guy's a hardcore Jewish Zionist. His father was Cedric Adams, that, you know, was the voice of the Midwest, who talked all those Germans and Poles into going into World War II. You know, so this is a propaganda family. So they moved in after 9/11, bought up all the media, and lo and behold, locals like myself are censored from being able to comment on that platform. They even banned me on Twitter, right? So when your local newspaper is out-of-state, Jewish-owned, you don't get a voice, because they're afraid that you might be that one voice that knocks that number down in the local population from 74% to less than 5%. And, you know, this is my ongoing battle here in, you know, this section of the mountains is, you know, I am not only banned from speaking on my local paper, but the entire Adams Publishing line. I cannot be heard. You know, that is their strategy. And the same thing with Appalachian State University. My first Twitter account, turns out it was Appalachian State University that got that account shut down under Jack Dorsey's leadership. When Elon Musk took over, I got a pardon from Elon Musk, and that, you know, totally irritated the Stasi over at App State, because now, even though they continue to hide my responses to their tweets, people can still see them. And it's causing, you know, quite a conniption fit over there, because I'm exposing their agenda. And they just, you know, they can't argue anything I say, so their responses just shut it down, right? So anyway, back to you.
So you are back on Twitter as a result of Elon Musk. So
that is true.
Ah, that is very good. But the bottom line is that despite them trying to shut you down, you are in many ways managing to leak out. And also with people having their own groups and their own little networks, we are able to get messages out despite the censorship. So they can't, they might be able to stop us from going totally viral, but they can't stop the leakage. What do you think?
Well, and people sat and watched the blacks burn down city after city here in the United States. So it's hard. I mean, unless you're a complete idiot, it's hard not to understand. And, you know, you got the cops. They're afraid to do their job. They're throw that. Well, they're throwing guys in jail and stuff. And when I grew up, I hated cops because they'd beat the crap out of you if you stepped out of line. But it's like, now I'm starting to appreciate that maybe that serves a purpose. I mean, you know, we've for the last 5-10 years, we've been sitting here watching blacks burn down city after city, and people raping women and getting away with it, and it's hard to deny. So, yeah, I mean, you know, people are starting to wake up to reality. And I tried to talk to the locals around here, and they're starting to understand that. And when you got the president of the United States going on and saying, you know, white people are the biggest problem in the country, you know, if you're white, it's like, well, that doesn't sound good. So the reality's smacking people in the face right now. So it's not even the matter of 1 out of 20 people speaking the truth. It's like the truth's hitting us in the face to a large extent. And you're even seeing that with the Tucker guy. He's starting to understand. It's like, well, yeah, these guys are out to get us. So, yeah, well, that's what we're experiencing.
But basically what you are saying is good news. You're basically saying that one way or the other, the people, even normal Americans, can it's almost impossible for them not to notice. And by the way, I'll tell you my little policeman story quickly. I remember in the early years when I was in South Africa and I just had my car license, and one day I was driving in Johannesburg, and most of the police in South Africa were Afrikaans, they're Boers, and they are the people who actually, they're the ones that are responsible for keeping the law in the time of white rule. Anyway, I remember one day a cop pulled me off the road and he said to me, by the way, you did this and this wrong. I'm not sure if I changed in a lane or something. And then he said to me, you know, that optional extra on your car, that side mirror, you know, you should consider looking into that sometime. So that was like his snarky comment to me, and I wasn't too charmed with that. But you're right. You know, nowadays when you see what actually replaces a guy like that, then you really feel, yeah, I do miss that guy. By the way, mentioning the police kneeling to the BLM, if you can ever find me any videos of that, please. I've been looking for that for years. The stuff that I'm looking for is, I'm looking for as much video footage of the time when BLM was burning down stuff, and especially for that time when Trump ordered the police to kneel to the blacks. If you can ever find that, please, I want to see that. Because I realized afterwards, nobody seems to be saving any of that. They burnt down $2 billion worth of buildings. And I don't have any film footage of any of that. So I'd appreciate that. But, you know, the other side of the story, Sid, is, you know, America is designed on the Roman Republic. And the Roman Republic was able to survive by having the ability to be dynamic and to re-energize itself whenever it went wrong. And it went wrong many times. And to me, it looks like the real secret, it looks to me like the real secret to you Americans is free speech. As long as you can talk, talking is the key.
Yeah, thank God for the First Amendment. I mean, I thank God every day for that because, I mean, you got that Sam Alia in Britain and they're throwing his ass in jail for, I mean, I don't know how many years because he was putting stickers out or something. I mean, so thank goodness for, is it 2 years?
2 years.
So, yeah. And I mean, I was in jail for 30 days and about killed me. So, yeah, I can't even imagine being in for 2 years. But, yeah, so thank goodness for our Constitution. And I think back to our founding fathers, it's like these guys were geniuses because they foresaw events right now. So I don't know. Yeah. So I do appreciate that we do have the First Amendment.
And you know, it's one of the things that they're trying so hard to get around is that First Amendment. And it's interesting that it was the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, which was formed in 1913 to protect a Jewish child rapist murderer. That was the whole Leo Frank thing. But they had a contest for all the college students in America to make a legal argument to explain why hate speech laws are needed. And basically, this hate speech is an Orwellian newspeak term to say there are certain things that don't follow under free speech, that you have hate speech, which is not allowed. That's why I always talk about my terms of hate facts, you know, to make a mockery of this whole thing of hate speech. And they want to have terms of service and community standards dictating what you can and can't say. And yeah, this is how things like the Watauga Democrat and Appalachian State University and Twitter and Facebook are able to silence you is because you are talking about things that are outside their community standards, their community guidelines about hate speech, you know, and you're identifying groups. And so I'm constantly having my ex tweets, you know, tagged for not being part of the community standards, right? But they let my account stay up, unlike Jack Dorsey, which pretty much, you know, once you got flagged, they just did away with your account with no appeal. At least with Elon's administration, they will flag your stuff and give it limited reach, as they say. You have freedom of speech, but not freedom of reach. But, you know, my tweets still stay up now. But that is the tactic they use. And now with artificial intelligence, in real time, you could have something monitoring what you're typing and refuse to let you publish it because it's offensive to the AI algorithm. And, you know, this is kind of what they're moving towards. And it drives me crazy when I'm using some package like Microsoft, you know, be it their email program or their Word document stuff, where it's typing ahead to finish my sentences for me, you know. And it's like, no, I don't want that. And it's like, at what point does Bill Gates say, oh, you can't use that word, and actually disable my keypad from typing that word, right? I mean, that's where they're going with this. It's complete, you know, the Orwellian 1984 model that they're trying to put up, because you know, the computer needs to think for us, because if you give a goyim freedom of speech and freedom and free will, they'll make the wrong choices or they'll be hateful and things like that. And so this is just social conditioning that they're doing. It's very Pavlovian in this constant beating you down of saying that's hateful, that's hateful, that's hateful, to if you don't bow down to their Marxist agenda. So back to you.
The thing that I just wanted to say is that they may try many things, but I'm not totally convinced that they can win if people focus on spreading messages. Because, I mean, that basically comes back to that psychological experiment that you were also mentioning, Frederick, that as long as there's something that's going against the grain, that totally changes it. I remember reading something very similar about propaganda, how propaganda works in military terms, that propaganda tends to work if it's almost 100% under one line. But the moment that you get even a little bit of dissenting stuff coming through, then propaganda loses a lot of its effectiveness. But now, a similar example of businesses and people like that trying to control you, I did a video, I don't know if you guys ever saw it, but I did a video about business. It was, I think the video was about whether small white business can defeat big Jewish business, something along those lines. I did quite a complex video and I gave examples of things that whites have done and things that have happened where whites have come into conflict with big corporations. And the best examples that I could find were farmers in America, where farmers and John Deere were coming to blows, literally. So John Deere is building harvesters, especially harvesters and tractors and things, and they've got very high-tech, computerized, satellite-linked kinds of software that works with the hardware. And then these farmers, so the farmers are getting a lot of productivity out of their harvesters, although at the same time, as they are harvesting their data, John Deere is busy getting the data. Oh, he's getting, you know, so many bushels an acre or whatever, or so many bags of corn per acre or whatever. But where it really came to blows, and it also was in the car industry as well, was when the farmers wanted to fix their own things, because John Deere basically came with very sophisticated systems that they build and they make it. And then when the harvester breaks, you got to take the harvester to John Deere, and only John Deere can fix it. And it's costing the farmers a lot of money. And the farmers are getting pissed off because the farmers are starting to figure out, but you know, in some cases, it's just a little sensor that I can buy for a couple of dollars. If I know what the problem is, then I can fix it myself. And then John Deere tried to come up with stuff to say, oh, you can't do it because the software is part of this and we own it, etc. And you know, farmers started doing illegal stuff, and they were even getting guys who were cracking into the software. It also happened with cars, with Mercedes-Benz, where people would go and other people would write software that cracks the car's software, and then mechanics can fix it. And I noticed in America, and even the phone companies and computer companies were following all this, because they were also trying to make it so that they build devices and things, and they are going to control you through their devices and all the abilities of the device. And I must tell you that I saw a lot of examples of white Americans fighting back and kicking this thing straight in the teeth, and that all you need are just enough pissed off whites. And it was lots of rural people, etc. People were going to their state legislature and stuff. And from what I can see, the whites are winning, or the whites are clobbering these big companies.
Well, I strongly hold, and we were talking about the First Amendment, the Second Amendment's important too, but I strongly hold if the whites get their backs up, we'll mop them up in no time flat. I mean, they just won't be able to stand against us for not even a second. So there's that. I mean,
I completely agree that, you know, the biggest problem is get the whites to get their head in the game. If the whites would get their head in the game, this would be over really fast. But to try to convince people that there's an urgency is very, very difficult, especially when you've got this multi-trillion-dollar propaganda bullhorn, you know, monopoly shouting down everything you're trying to say. But the interesting thing about the tractors, it just goes against the grain of the American experiment of private property. And it's very similar, the same business model of you don't really own the product you just bought. We're not going to allow you to fix it. You have to bring it into us. We're going to continue to tax it, et cetera, et cetera. This was not only fundamental to the tractor industry from the get-go, but also the telephone industry. For the longest time, you could not own your own telephone in the United States. You could not own a private modem in the United States. And it was the, I think it was the Davis Act that finally changed that in the 60s so that you could have, you know, different phone companies spring up in the United States making different equipment for the phone system. But, you know, with the tractor industry, these farmers are realizing that this industry has been weaponized against them in favor of the corporate farms, right? That the corporations are buying up more tractors. They want all this high-tech robotics, but the family farm, you're at a disadvantage now intentionally. And just, you know, amazes me that, yes, you can't fix your own tractor. It really doesn't. When you look at all the legalese of what's in the contracts when you buy a tractor from John Deere, you realize that you're really not buying the tractor. You're just basically acquiring the use of it from the company. So that's an interesting legal thing on private property.
Yeah. Well, I have gotten a kick out of the French farmers. They're raising hell. And it seems like
the Dutch farmers. Yeah. He's going to get the farmers riled up. That's what we need. I would love for the farmers here to protest like App State's homecoming parade or something like that. Just have 8,000 tractors and equipment show up and just bring the town to a standstill to protest all this craziness that's being imposed on us from these carpetbaggers.
Yeah, very interesting stuff. Well, Second Amendment, I always tell people the Second Amendment is more important than the First Amendment, because even if you lose out on everything else, is it the Second Amendment, the one with the guns, ownership of firearms?
Yes. Yes, gives you the authority to back up the First Amendment.
Second Amendment fixes anything else. So, you know, you Americans are still cool. The only thing that I see that's hurting you is the Jews are aggressively trying to destroy you and terrorize you as individuals. And as long as you just keep fighting the word game, that is the most important thing. The one thing I've always concluded since I got into this, the one thing that I always concluded is the time when we will lose, when we will die, is if we go silent. Silence, that will kill
actually
us.
I want to say something about that, because I remember when Francis Fukuyama came out with his The End of History, and it was the idea that liberal democracy had taken over everything, and it was the end of history. And I was a kid when it came out, and I was sad, but I'm like sort of excited now. It's like, yeah, fuck. Let's sorry for my language, but yeah, let's get busy. I mean, history has started up again, and you know, I think people should be excited. And it's like, okay, let's fight it out.
Well, when we get,
I be speaking too freely.
No, it's excellent. No problem. No problems. We have no problems with anything you said there. Nor the tone that you said it in. Excellent. Whites also need to get angry as well. But, yeah. I think that maybe we can wind up. We've gone a bit over time, but I didn't want to mess with things because we were on a roll there. And any final thoughts from either of you?
No, I'm finished. But I think history has started up again, so people need to get their heads in the game. And Blackbird 9 is entirely correct. Whites need to get their heads in the game. Because if not, your kids are going to suffer.
Exactly. And I've just thoroughly enjoyed this. That was a fast hour. I really enjoyed the conversation and the fellowship here. And like we say at the Trading Post, wake up, level up, party up. You know, get your head in the game, figure out what it is you need to correct your thinking on, you know, figure out, you know, what is the game, what's at foot, and, you know, get your groups together. You know, that's the thing, local groups. You're going to revitalize your family unit because, you know, whether you like it or not, we're all at war. It's just a different kind of war. So thanks again for having me on.
It's a pleasure having both of you guys on. And it actually wasn't even an hour. It was an hour and a half. So time flew. And I really appreciated your input. And that's what I'm also telling people here is that, you know, history never stops. You know, the blacks thought all across Africa, when I look at the history of how the blacks were looking at fighting the whites, the blacks all thought that they fight the whites, they get rid of the whites, and then it's heaven forever thereafter. And actually not. History rolls forward, and they got all kinds of problems, they never even imagined. And I love it to bits. And so the notion that history stops, that's bullshit. That history never stops, and as long as you're alive, you can carry on. And the other thing that I think I'd like to add in is, all whites need to build up networks, personal networks. You've got a network and talk to people, get to know other people, get to meet them, get to liaise with them, because the only way out of this is to stick together. And if we stick together and we form bonds and we can work in trusting relationships once we understand each other, I really don't see anything that can stop us. You know, whatever the Jews do, there's nothing that the Jews do that is so fantastic and so difficult that we can't do the same thing and a whole bunch better. It's just that nobody's used to this weird kind of war that only Jews wage. So that'll be my final words on this.
Amen, brother.
If you don't see the end, if you don't see the top, don't stop. We know you'll win every fight.